Welcome to Let's Talk. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners across the country where the program's broadcast, particularly the local traditional owners, the Jagera, Yagera, Turrbal and Yugrupul peoples, the Yugambeh, Mananjali, Kombamiri, Noonuckle and Quandamooka peoples. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the first peoples of the land and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country via the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, blue sky and sunshine here in Brisbane today, but let's hope it's a great day wherever you are. You don't necessarily need blue sky and sunshine. It can be cloudy and overcast and raining, and it'll still be a beautiful day. I certainly like each day as it comes anyway. My guest today, he's been known to have been an activist, an actor, an academic, an arts bureaucrat, a museum curator, and a writer. He also was an announcer on Radio Redfern. He doesn't seem, I don't think he tells too many people that. But anyway, he's recently completed a PhD in history and is a lecturer in history at Victoria University. Today he sort of describes himself as an elderly anarchist agitator. He's a columnist with Tracker. Has a column called The Contrarian. And I'd like to welcome Gary Foley. Gary, welcome to the program, brother. How are you?
Morning, Tiger. Greetings, everybody. I'm good.
Tell us your mob, your country.
I'm from Goombangia country on the north coast of New South Wales. Ginagai, all you Goombangia mob who are listening in.
What towns, considering some of our listeners might be tuned in from across the north and the west and down south, what area, what are some of the landmarks?
Nambucca Heads, mate, the most beautiful place on the east coast in Australia.
It certainly is a beautiful place. I mean, you can't argue that. It certainly is. Now, you've had an interesting life over the years for a young fella.
So far.
Yeah, so far. Well, you're probably making it more interesting each day goes along, but you've recently completed your PhD last year.
Dr. Foley now.
Dr. Foley, the little black doc.
I say to people, not this little black doc.
Good one.
It took me 10 years, mate. It was 10 years of blood, sweat and tears, but it was well and truly worth it. And I'd say to anyone out there, if I can go to uni late in life at the age of 50 and spend 13 years there and get a PhD, so can you.
Yes, no, it's certainly quite an achievement, and congratulations on that. I mean, that's a massive achievement. Ross, who you know, my mother's younger brother, Ross Watson, yep, is just doing in the final stages of handing his completed thesis in.
Oh, well, I wish you well, Ross, out there. Brother?
Yes, and he's only just turned 69 a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. So
He did a bit of teaching down here with us in the mid 70s at Swinburne College. I still got pictures of him there.
Ah, good one. Yeah. Yeah. Now, what has it done for you? The reason I ask, like to complete a PhD, to go on with this further education, what's it done for you? And the reason I ask is, I was talking to Professor Aileen Morton Robinson, one of our local women up here, and she started out in a similar, like on the streets marching, involved in organisations at meetings, back in the early 70s, when organisations were being established. And she said, Tiger, she said, I felt that there was more I could do, and I needed that education, I needed those qualifications to be able to complete her as a person, I think was her words. But what is it it done for you?
I think that's a pretty accurate statement by Aileen, and incidentally, she's a great writer, and she's one of the ones who inspired me along the way. You know, I think she's done some great work, but it does great things to you personally. I mean, it's broadened my horizon, my understanding. I can argue my case better now. I mean, I set out on this journey because halfway through my life, when I was in my late 40s, I started to read historical accounts about the sort of things that we'd been involved in, like the Aboriginal Embassy and other stuff, other events around that era. And these accounts were being written by non-Aboriginal historians, and invariably they get it wrong. And worse still was a new generation of amateur Aboriginal historians, like somebody from up Cape York somewhere, who seem, because of their own political agenda, determined to denigrate the achievements of the era of self-determination. And I thought it was important to arm myself to enter that battle, that argument. You know, there was a huge thing called the History Wars that went on for 10 years in Australia, where you had people like Keith Windschuttle and other revisionists trying to remake our history again. I mean, Aboriginal people were largely ignored in Australian history right up until the mid-1960s. There was a brief period when the Aboriginal voice began to get through, but it was coming through courtesy of non-Aboriginal historians like Humphrey McQueen and Henry Reynolds and others. And there's a group of us who thought it was important that Aboriginal people tell their own stories or tell it from our perspective, you know. And that's the sort of stuff that motivated me.
Yes, it is essential that we have our own historians. How many First Nations historians do we have, do you know?
Not a lot, mate.
Yes, I figured that.
I think Gordon Briscoe can claim credit for being just about the first. At Melbourne University, which has been going for more than 150 years, the history department there has managed in 150 years to only turn out three. I was the second Aboriginal historian to come through Melbourne Uni. The first was Tony Birch, who's now transformed into a brilliant novelist, just got nominated for the Miles Franklin last year. And there's another young woman called Crystal McKinnon who came along behind me, but that's it for University of Melbourne, and that's one of the top universities in the country.
Wow.
And I think we've also got to remember that, you know, Aboriginal people for the greater part of the 20th century were denied educational opportunities. I mean, you know, when I went to school in the 60s on the north coast of New South Wales, despite us being a considerable portion of the local population, there were only three of us in the local high school, you know. And like I say, it took me till I was 50 before I managed to get to university. And you look at in other comparable countries like Canada, America, New Zealand, where you've got Indigenous peoples, the first Canadian native university graduate was about 200 years ago, you know, same in America, the same with African Americans a couple hundred years ago. The first Maori in New Zealand to graduate from a university was about 150 years ago. So, you know, and when was the first university graduate in Australia? In about 1958.
Mm.
And there wasn't another one, you know, for another 10 years or so when Charlie Perkins and come through. The first Aboriginal lawyer wasn't till Pat O'Shane in 1978. The first Aboriginal doctor didn't graduate till the 1980s. You know, this is a shameful record for Australia. And it now that there are Aboriginal people out there gaining some educational qualifications and expertise, one would hope there'd be some change. But, you know, for any Aboriginal kid who's going to go to uni, I'd warn you, it's a tough struggle maintaining your own, you know, census perspective and your own identity, because most of the people you'll find teaching the Aboriginal studies, both in universities and high schools around the country, are non-Aboriginal people who learnt their history from books written by non-Aboriginal historians. So it's still a long way to go, Cass.
It certainly is. And it isn't necessarily true, although there's a strong thought out there among our mob, that the world of academia can mean that you lose your identity, that you become more assimilated, but that is not necessarily the case.
Well, this is what I'm saying. You know, I think it's the biggest danger of all for people who go to university. I think it's important for you to, I mean, the ideal situation to be in is to be in with a mob of people. You know, when I went to uni at Melbourne Uni, there was a Aboriginal centre there, and there was a good bunch of people around me who, you know, and we all reinforced each other, you know, and when we, because there's an extraordinary amount of racism in the various faculties in all the universities, And it's a difficult thing for Aboriginal people to contend with, because there's still, even amongst, you know, educated elites, there's still a high level of hostility towards Aboriginal people, whether people like to admit it or not.
That's unquestionably the case right across the country. I was only talking to Greg McLean yesterday. He's the mayor of Hopevale, up northwest or west of Cooktown, was on air with me. He'd recently been pepper sprayed, handcuffed, and charged with six or more charges. And the three, the trifecta, normally what you get, if it's not obstruct police or disobey police direction, you get that along with resist arrest and language, obscene language or something, you know. Now, he's the mayor, and I said, do you know of any other mayors? I mean, I can't think of any other mayor out in the white side of town in mainstream Australia, of a shire council, a mayor of any local government area, that's been locked up and treated the way you are. And I just think there is this attitude towards First Nations people, whether they're mayor or not, they are still nothing but scum of the earth in the eyes of the establishment.
Well, the proof of the pudding in that is the jail statistics in Australia. Aboriginal people are pretty much the most imprisoned people on the planet, you know, proportionally, which was the case, almost 30 years ago or whenever it was, when the Royal Commission in Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, a $50 million exercise that was a lawyer's picnic, the primary thing that came out of that was they realised that so many blackfellas were dying in jails in Australia because there were so many blackfellas in jail. And so the primary recommendations of the Royal Commission were designed to stop Aboriginal people from going to jail at the rate that they were. This wasn't because Aboriginal people were more criminal or anything. It was more about the racism that is embedded in the criminal justice system in Australia. Now, that was 30 years ago. And there's many more Aboriginal people in jail today than there were then, you know. So, I mean, the racism that Australians are always in denialism about is nevertheless deeply embedded, not just in the society generally, but especially in many of the institutions, including the criminal justice system and including the education system. And so that's why it's really important for Aboriginal people who go to uni especially, is to do everything you can to maintain contact within your own community, keep your feet on the ground, remember where you come from, and remember what your purpose in being there is. You know, of all of the different mobs of Aboriginal people who go to uni these days, it seems to me that the majority are doing law, which seems to be a fairly pointless exercise to me. In one sense, because we've now got an army of Aboriginal lawyers, the jail rates aren't any different than they used to be. They don't seem to be having much of an effect. I mean, if you become a lawyer, you operate within the rules of that system. I mean, I think that young curries, whoever, going into uni ought to be given a lot better advice about what career choices they make. I mean, if people really want to make a difference out there in society, it's good to arm yourself with education, but you got to be careful about what sort of education you arm yourself with. And I don't particularly think that becoming a lawyer is a good way if you want to change the world.
Mm. And a lot of those lawyers don't really get into the courtrooms. They're usually working in policy or administration or somewhere else.
And the same, yeah, that's right. And the same with, and the really sad thing is that it's the same, seems to me to be pretty much the same with medical professionals, doctors, you know. Too many of them end up as desk jockeys rather than working in the community health clinics that are out there, you know.
Mm.
And people should remember that when we first set up, when they were really good, that is, the first legal services and first Aboriginal medical service, health clinics around Australia, community-controlled organisations. This is in the early 70s, we had to employ non-Aboriginal lawyers and non-Aboriginal doctors for the simple reason that there were no Aboriginal doctors and no Aboriginal lawyers at that time. Now there's a lot more doctors about. I don't see most of them working in the community, which, you know, I would have thought ought to be the purpose of any Aboriginal person who wanted to become a doctor. If you just go into university to look after yourself and, think about your own career and nothing else, then you ought to question whether you're still an Aboriginal, whether you haven't been assimilated along the way.
Tell us about those early days. I was going to ask you, again, to mention community-controlled organisations in the late 60s and 70s when they started to become established. And we've only just in the last couple of years seen the 40th anniversary of, I think it was last year, down the Medical Centre, or the Aboriginal Medical Centre Redfern. It might have been the year before. But we're seeing the big 40th turnover now. And only in a week or so, we've got the a big dinner in town organised by the Institute of Urban, the Indigenous Urban Institute of Health here. A dinner for the 40th anniversary achievement of organisations like Black Community Housing, like Legal Service, like the Health Service. That was the way that was identified by community, members of the community. You were part of that Redfern community at the time when they decided it was time to make these changes. If there were changes to be made, we had to do it ourselves.
Well, people have got to remember that those sort of organisations, the original versions of them, which was the best version, I think too many of those organisations have evolved into something completely different from what they started out as. But in the beginning, people have got to remember that all of those organisations, all of those concepts were ideas that came out of the Black Power movement in the late 60s and early 70s, you know. People still scared of using terms like Black Power, but, you know, and people used to say that, oh, Black Power, that's about black racism and black violence, which it wasn't. It was about black empowerment, you know, the fundamental right of Aboriginal people to control their own affairs. You know, most people don't know that during the campaign for the 1967 referendum, the organisation responsible for that campaign, our only national Aboriginal organisation of that era, was not in fact controlled by Aboriginal people. You know, the Whakatse was not controlled by Aboriginal people. So for Aboriginal people to control their own affairs was an important thing. And we'd been subject to, you know, various state government laws for almost 100 years prior to that, that robbed us of any basic self-determination whatsoever. And that's why self-determination was such a key issue in those days. And the Black Power movement looked around the world at a variety of situations where people had been colonised or done over by imperialism, and we looked at ways in which they were responding to that racist and colonial oppression. And we adopted and adapted a range of ideas, adopted them from, you know, places like the Black Panther Party in America. That's where the idea that evolved into the first Aboriginal Legal Service came from. When we read about, in Redfern, I was 17 years old, I read the autobiography of Malcolm X. I'd still recommend any black fellow in Australia who wants to get a bit of a political lesson, read the autobiography of Malcolm X. That's your starting point. If you want to become a political activist, read that. But when I read the autobiography of Malcolm X, I could relate. I was sitting in Redfern, the biggest Aboriginal community in Australia at the time and ever, around about 30,000 people, it became in the late 1960s. And we were an impoverished community, subject to extraordinary police harassment and brutality. And when we read about the experience of people, African-American people in the Oakland, California community, what their experience of police brutality was, we could relate to that. We could understand that because that was happening to us. And when we looked at the way in which they set about to do something about responding to that police brutality, they set up a thing called the Pig Patrol. They armed themselves and said they were defending their community. I mean, in Sydney and Redfern in late 1960s, we considered that option, but that option wasn't open to us. So we looked at an alternative way, which evolved into, you know, we set up a police monitoring thing, gathered an enormous amount of information, and ultimately that evolved into the first free shopfront legal aid centre in Australia. We, in fact, introduced the idea of free legal aid into Australia in the late 60s and early 70s. You know, these are aspects of history that people don't know. But it's important to know these aspects because people can't really make sense of what is happening today in Australia unless you've got an understanding of history. And that includes recent history, the history of the last 50 years in particular.
What is...
That was a long rave. I'm sorry about that.
No, the microphone's yours. That's what I want. I mean, it is important that you, one, as a First Nations man, two, as a man that was around back in the late 60s and 70s and reading the likes of Malcolm X, which I also did in 1970, 71. It's
and
important.
You'd agree with me, wouldn't you, that one of the best books as a starting point for Aboriginal person who wants to, you know, develop their political awareness a bit more.
A great place to start. And once you get a bit of an understanding, The Wretched of the Earth by Franz Fanon is a much heavier book and a little bit more difficult to get through and understand. But once you get some understanding, it'll be one of the next to get into.
And if a bunch of young kids, which is what we were in the late 60s, early 70s, if a bunch of young black kids sitting in a, you know, in my case, sitting in a place like Redfern, can pick up a book like Wretched of the Earth or Autobiography of Malcolm X and read it and relate to it, then anyone can, you know. It's one of the, these are the, you know, there's an old story about the Black Panthers in America about some young guy who, you know, hated white fellas and wanted to, saw the Panthers walking around with guns and wanted to get in on that, wanted to carry a gun and everything. And he went into the Panthers' office and he said to him, "Brother, I want to join the Panthers, you know. Give me arms." And the bloke, the Panther guy, reached into his desk and pulled out a pile of books. And the young guy said, "I thought you were going to arm me." And the Black Panther said, "I just did, brother. Go away and read these."
Yes.
You know?
That's the start of it.
And, I mean, the good thing about them days as well is that somehow or other we were motivated into self-education ourselves. Most of us had only got a little bit of, you know, in those circumstances in those days, we're only given a little opportunity to education. But when I left school, like somebody once said, you know, my education really started when I left school. And in Redfern, we formed a little reading group. Paul Coe was at the head of that. And we encouraged each other to read. And we learned. We taught ourselves. You know, at the end of the day, what we went through was self-education. But by gee, that self-education resulted in some pretty extraordinary stuff. I mean, you know, it culminated. I mean, you know, there were things happening in Brisbane, there were things happening in Melbourne, Adelaide, in conjunction with all of that. And it culminated in us contributing to the bringing down of a government in 1972. The Aboriginal Embassy was the high point of the Aboriginal resistance in the 20th century, you know. And in certain ways, it's been downhill ever since. We've seen the emergence of too many coconuts. We've seen the emergence of too many public servants. And
there are too many assimilated blacks.
Well, people should remember that we gave the government of Australia a hell of a fright in 1972 with the embassy. The international headlines we got, the severe embarrassment with the McMahon government, and when Whitlam came in, he was determined not to let that happen to him. And so they figured the best way to neutralise what was to sign that little contract, being a public servant, that shuts their mouth forever. And one of the most effective means that the government ever employed against the Aboriginal resistance was to recruit some of the best and sharpest minds into the public service. And many of those people going around today masquerading as the elders of the Aboriginal movement are in fact people who came out of the public service, who are products of the public service, not of Aboriginal community organisations or things like that.
Yeah. I've got a caller on the line. After the caller, I want to ask you, what are the changes you see with community-controlled organisations? When you say the original forms came from community, when you look around and see today, what is it that you see? And what needs to be done to assist and go back to that pure form? But here's a call on the line. Peter would like to make a comment. Peter, welcome to the program.
Hi. Yeah, not so much a comment, a question for Gary and yourself. Okay, now, I find this all very interesting, and you're quite right, you know, like the consciousness of, you know, the oppression of and the colonialization of the local peoples, as well as, oh shit, I've got to take this call there. But anyway, basically, I've got to ask, what is the practical political steps we can take nowadays to advance the black people? Okay,
all right.
Sorry, I've got to go.
Thank you.
Well, I would argue that it's pretty much the same as what we were arguing 40 years ago. And not only that, people were arguing the same thing back in the 1920s. You know, the first modern-day Aboriginal political organisation, the old Australian Aborigines Progressive Association in New South Wales. From that point on, we've always argued for what we've got to have is self-determination. We've got to regain control of our own affairs. How do we do that in the sort of Australia that surrounds us now? Well, you look at the sort of Australia that surrounds us now, and it's obvious that money talks. So the only way you're going to gain freedom in this sort of society is to have economic independence. The white fellas do it as individuals. Okay, that's fine. That's their way. But that's not our way. If we're going to do it, we've got to go ahead together. We've got to develop our own economic independence as clans, extended families, as nations, whatever. Now, if you're going to try and strive towards economic independence as a means to self-determination, then what do you need first and foremost? You need land. Land that can be utilised as an economic base from which to develop the sort of economic enterprises that are not in conflict with your basic cultural values, but economic enterprises which nevertheless generate resources, generate employment, generate income into communities, income that is not tied to public service strings. This is not government grant sort of territory where you get a 155-page list of conditions of grant. This is money that you generate yourself, and as communities you then determine yourselves how that money's spent, what the priorities are, whether those priorities are improving the health and sanitation of the local community, improving the housing, whatever. But in doing that, we're spending our own money. We don't have to answer to no public servant in Canberra or no politician in Canberra. That's what economic independence is all about, regaining control of our own affairs. We need to be independent in the Australia of today. If we don't gain our own independence back, then the path ahead is a pure path to assimilation. The assimilation project is well advanced in Australia. And I would, you know, if things keep going like they are, then I can safely predict that in about 50 to 75 years' time, the genocide will be complete. The assimilation project will have achieved its aims. There will be no more Aboriginal people in Australia. There'll be a bunch of coconuts running around calling themselves Aboriginal people, but they won't be Aboriginal in terms of their values, culturally.
Yes, what is it? What is it that determines you as a First Nations man, as a Goombangi man? What is it?
Well, the white fellas society and culture is very big on individualism. That's the opposite of what the basic Aboriginal ethos is. You know, the basic Aboriginal ethos is I'm my brother or sister's keeper, and the welfare of the group is more important than the welfare of the individual. Materialism, you know, this is why I say that it sometimes worries me that where the assimilation project's very advanced. Materialism is not in the bones. It's not in Aboriginal people, you know. We share. We're not about accumulating vast amounts of wealth as individuals, you know. And these are the sort of basic values that we have to fight hard to retain, because the sort of values that are taught to kids in school today and the sort of values of the broader society around us that infect us are values that are diametrically the opposite of what an Aboriginal person should be thinking, like, and worrying about and caring about.
Okay. When you look around and see Aboriginal, and I agree. I mean, it's just, I don't know, Gary, what it is.
Going back to your question before that other fella asked his question.
Organisations.
In terms of organisations, I look around and the organisations, most of the organisations that I see that we created or evolved from the ideas that came out of Redfern and Brisbane and Melbourne in the late 60s, early 70s, these organisations have evolved into different things to what they used to be. And you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out why that is. All you've got to do is go and read George Orwell's Animal Farm, you know. And I would put it to people who've read that book that the pigs are walking on two legs these days, you know. And too many of these organisations have evolved through appropriation by public service type Aboriginal people, or just a breakdown in, you know, whatever, corruption or whatever you want to call it. But too many of these organisations have evolved into being the very sort of institutions that they were created to be an alternative to in the first place, you know.
And is that due to dictate by the government with funding part of, some of?
Well, I mean, that was the real control that government got over those organisations. In the beginning, we operated the legal services on a voluntary basis. We rounded up a crew of about 70 young gun white lawyers in Sydney who were prepared to donate a few hours a week on a roster basis and provide legal advice and legal assistance to Aboriginal people who are being arbitrarily arrested in Redfern. Now, we functioned like that for a while, and the same thing with the first Aboriginal Medical Service in Redfern. It was operated on a voluntary basis, but very quickly the medical problems in Redfern overwhelmed us, and we were forced to go to government and seek some sort of financial assistance. Now, had we have known what was going to happen in the long run, had we have realised that, you know, today you go try and get a grant out of government, like I said, you've got to fill in a form, an application form, that's about 100 pages long that even me with a PhD would have trouble figuring out and filling in, you know.
You've got to jump through a lot of hoops. So and what would have been the alternative?
The important thing of all is the strings that are attached through those.
That's right.
Conditions of grant. That's how governments have managed to control the development of Aboriginal organisations in the last 40 years.
So hindsight being the wonderful thing that it is, what would be the option then, the alternative? It's a struggle. It's getting overwhelming the issues, the health issues. Okay, we'll go and get some money and start paying people. What, in hindsight, was the option?
Well, the best option was what we were proposing way back then. I mean, we always said that the health service and the legal service and these organisations we were creating were merely stopgap measures. That's why we call them community survival programs. We call them community survival programs because we believed that they were just there to enable the community to survive until such time as the ultimate answer became reality. And that ultimate answer in our minds then was the concept of land rights. That embraces all of those things I talked about before. That gives you the land from which to do your economic development, which generates the income, which generates the employment, which generates the resources, which you can then start to take care of yourself without going cap in hand to government. You know, and we came close to getting land rights. Remember that in 1972, when the Aboriginal Embassy was on the lawns of Parliament House, Gough Whitlam came wandering over to Big Note himself. He was the leader of the opposition. He made a big speech about, you know, all you've got to do is vote for the Labor Party and we'll look after you. And he got interrupted in that speech by Paul Coe, who said, challenge Whitlam. And he said to Whitlam, well, hang on a sec, your party's policy is assimilation. The Liberal government across the road, their policy is assimilation. What's the difference between you lot? And Whitlam, to his credit at that time, realised the logic and power of Coe's argument, and he went away and he changed ALP policy. And for the first time in the 20th century, you had an opposition that now had a different policy to the government. Right up until that moment when Coe challenged Whitlam, there had been bipartisan agreement that the policy on Aborigines should be assimilation. Aborigines should be assimilated, absorbed into the white community and essentially wiped out. The policy of assimilation was always a policy of genocide. Now, when Whitlam changed that policy, that meant the end of assimilation. And so Whitlam's alternative policy was he declared in the 1972 federal election campaign his government would grant Aboriginal land rights to Aboriginal people all over Australia. Now, within 6 months of Whitlam getting elected, Whitlam realised the extent of the racist opposition that existed in the states out there, and he backed off at a million miles an hour. And before you knew it, the CIA knocked Whitlam off, and that was the end of that. And then, you know, another 10 years later, along comes Bob Hawke saying the same thing. My government will grant Aboriginal people land rights. Well, it didn't take long for the corrupt Premier of Western Australia and the powerful interests of the West Australian mining industry to knock that idea in the head, and that was the end of land rights. And then, you know, next thing you know, Keating gives us native title.
Native title.
The most inferior form of land tenure under British law. Meaningless. You know, native title is not land rights. That's all your listeners need to know, folks.
And reconciliation is not self-determination.
Reconciliation is not justice. You know, we ain't got justice. We ain't got land rights. We're still pretty much where we were 40 years ago.
Yes.
But if anything, the struggle looks a lot more difficult today. In certain ways, we were lucky to turn 18. Well, I was lucky to turn 18 in the year of 1968. That was the year of universal protest, you know. The winds of change were sweeping through Africa. Many of the colonised African nations were becoming independent. The civil rights movement in America had impact. Even the flower generation, even the hippies were ruffling the feathers of the establishment around the world. So it was an exciting and good time for all of these planets to align. And I think that in that sense, politically, we were sort of lucky. We got a lot of support from a lot of good white people, especially in the trade union movement, especially amongst the student movement, you know, all sorts of different outfits. We pulled together, and we all believed collectively that we could change the world. And we did. Only trouble was that along comes, government straight after that and changed it back. So my advice to any future revolutionaries is you can change the world. It is possible to change the world. But when you do, next time, make sure they don't change it back.
Now, there's been a few terms that you've just raised here. One was black power.
Mm-hmm.
Another was self-determination, we hear a little bit more of still today.
We usually hear it today is Noel Pearson's shit candidate.
Yes, yes. So... Yeah. What do we, when we're setting up organisations, what are some of the key elements there that need to be, what we need to be mindful of? Again, with hindsight, knowing what was set up back in the late 60s, early 70s, seeing how they've been changed, what do we do today in regards to these organisations?
Well, I mean, people want to do the same, they've got to do what we did. And that first thing is you've got to educate yourself. You know, shake off a lot of the shackles of the education, you know, mainstream education you got. Educate yourself about what's going on in the world and then go and educate the people around you, you know, because in order to start any sort of movement, you've got to have a following. And if you've got a following, if you've got a bunch of people there, like-minded people who you're taking with you, both, you know, in terms of education and politically, then, you know, you look around your community, which is what we did. We said we didn't need telling that the problem in Redfern in the late 60s was police brutality and police harassment, because all of us got a kick. And my political education, I've always said, began in 1967 when I got a good kicking from the thugs of the New South Wales Police Force in the old Regent Street Police Station. You know, 1 week later, Paul Coe comes along and thrusts the autobiography of Malcolm X into my hand, and he says, read this. And 1 week later, he come back to me and he said, hey, listen, we're thinking about setting up a little group to see if we can do something about these coppers in Redfern. Well, you know, he didn't have to ask me twice. And, you know, the Black Power movement in Sydney really started with just three or four people, you know, and we built it up from that, you know, and within a couple of years, we were getting headlines all over the world with the Aboriginal Embassy, and we had the government buy the short and curlies because they didn't know what to do with us. And the only way they could move us was introduce a special law, and then they smashed us, which was an even worse public relations disaster for them than it was for us.
Certainly was. Look, you've mentioned you were 18 when you... I was some 16, 17. Everybody, the... Williams, Coe, Craigie, Tony Curry, Norma Ingram, all these people around were young teenagers, Gary.
We're all teenagers.
We're all young teenagers.
That's right.
And
none of us wasn't a university degree amongst us, mate.
Exactly.
And yet we managed to change the world.
Looking around you today, what do you see with our young ones? What words of encouragement? What advice? What do you see?
I give as much encouragement as I can. I'm depressed by the extent to which I see they've been already indoctrinated into white fellow's way of thinking. But then every now and then I see a young fellow like down here in Melbourne, young Nathan Lovett Murray, plays resident. Now there is a truly admirable young man, putting his footy money into developing a hip-hop record company and creating opportunities for young couriers and being a spectacularly good role model for his community down here and beyond. You know, if we had give me a dozen Nathan Lovett Murrays, mate, and we can start afresh. But there's Nathan Lovett Murrays in all communities yes. around Australia. Now yes. there's good, strong people who are in their own way trying to set a good example and set that good example as an Aboriginal person rather than assimilated person or pseudo white person, and they relate to Aboriginal values. One of the reasons Nathan Lovett Murray is such a good young guy, his father's Gary Murray, one of my oldest political friends and associates in Victoria, who's fought more battles than most people have had hot feeds.
Yeah, he was one of the land council people.
He
was involved with the land councils when I was down there. Yeah, we often met and had good yarns.
Well, about 10 years ago, he had the British Museum by the Short and Curlies, and we almost won that battle. But in the process of losing it, we made a lot of friends around the world and raised a lot more awareness around the world about, the issue of Aboriginal stuff being in white museums.
Mm-hmm. A little over 6 months ago up here in Brisbane, we celebrated the 30th anniversary of the Commonwealth Games. You were in the middle of that. What memories come back? What were the achievements?
The achievements were many. We put the wind up the Hawke government. The Hawke came to power the following year. And when Hawke had seen, just how coordinated and effective and how brave Aboriginal political activists could be, because, it was incredibly brave to be in Brisbane during those Commonwealth Games, because Joe Bjerke-Peterson had created special laws that, effectively said that any three people gathering together in anywhere in the state of Queensland would be deemed some sort of illegal meeting and they could be arrested on site sort of thing. He created laws to make street marching illegal. And Aboriginal people said, we don't care if you make it illegal, we're going to come and march anyway. And march they did. And in the process, made headlines around the world and again reminded the world what was going on in Australia, that, all the money that the Australian government spends on promoting a really false and good image of Australia is wrong. And so one of the things I remember best about the Commonwealth Games, though, every time I sort of see a bit of footage from it, is I'm making a speech there in Roma Street Forum one day, making this real radical speech, and standing behind me, holding a flag, making out he's my minder, and looking real radical, is none other than Warren Mundine.
I point that out to everybody.
That's one of the great things about being a historian. You can watch the way people's careers develop over a long period of time, and, you can sometimes remind them of what they used to be before they went funny.
Yes, it was always also in frame when you were making a speech when Fraser attended the Greek Club across the road on Edmondson Street.
He was trying to get into the camera range in that one.
Warren was also in frame there. Now, black political.
I'd like to wish Warren a very happy wedding. He got married recently.
He did.
And appropriately enough, it was held at Luna Park in Sydney. And just for those of you out there who don't know, he married Gerard Henderson's daughter. Now, those of you who are in the know what that means. If you don't know what that means, it means you don't know enough.
All right.
There you go.
Now, black political parties. What are your thoughts? We've got Murray Jupiter Ryan up there, Gurindji man, trying to set up and establish candidates. We've got the federal election coming up, which I want to talk to you about. The quality of politician, our options, state, federal level is just pathetic. But black political parties first. What are your thoughts?
Well, I would have thought that the last thing that Aboriginal Australia needs is more politicians. The last thing Australia needs is more politicians. The simple truth of the matter for anyone who studies history and studies politics is that all politicians are bastards, and it doesn't matter who you vote for, a politician gets in. I've got absolutely zero faith in politicians. I've dealt with literally hundreds of Australian politicians ever since the days of Billy McMahon, you know, over the last 40, 45 years or so, and I'm struggling. Well, I can't think of a single politician who I've ever met who I could say that I have the slightest bit of respect for. You know, as a class of people, they're just dishonest. They're all about self-interest, and they will always sell you down the drain. I don't care whether they're black or white. A black politician is no different to a white politician to me. All politicians are bastards. That's my answer to that.
All right. And the federal election coming up, 14th of September, we seem to be bankrupt insofar as, again, common sense or any substance with any of the politicians at the federal level. What do we do? What are your thoughts?
Well, as you introduced me, I'm an old anarchist agitator. I don't vote. I don't see the point in voting. I mean, what have we got? We've got a brutal, racist ALP that demonises Aboriginal people, terrorises asylum seekers, penalises the poor, and is wedded to some sort of lunatic, neoliberal, voodoo economics. And the Libs are even worse. So if that's the choice, where's the choice? There is no choice. So if there's no choice, why bother voting? I'm not advocating that to everybody in Australia. I mean, if people are still deluded enough to think that their vote might make a difference, then they're quite welcome to go and exercise it. I just don't believe in it. I don't believe in the Australian political system. So I don't involve myself. I don't waste my time.
With your work, you're a lecturer in history.
Indeed.
It would be... Well, I also want to acknowledge the website you've established, which is an amazing thing too. But that would be quite challenging for some to have you as their lecturer, blacks and whites.
They love it, mate. They love me. Because where else in the Australian tertiary education system are they going to get a lecturer like me who don't care, who'll tell them the truth no matter what, whether they like it or not? And I say to my students, I say, I don't want you to believe what I say. I want you to go out, if you think I'm wrong, go out and find the evidence and prove me wrong.
Prove you wrong. You know? Mm.
And if you can prove me, and I'm not always right. I've been proven wrong at least twice in 10 years by my students. But in the process of them, if they don't like what I say and if they disagree with me, then they accept the challenge that I throw to them. And that in itself is a good educational process for them, because more often than not always, but more often than not, they come to realise that, you know, what I was saying was right.
Mm. Before we go into your website, you were involved in Radio Redfern, must be some over 30, 40 years ago, early 80s.
I was involved even earlier than that in radio. Me and Bruce McGuinness did the first regular Aboriginal radio program on Australian radio way back in the early 70s, about 71, in Melbourne on a station called 3ZZZ. It was a mingy 15 minutes a week, but that was all right. We had fun. And some of those tapes are still around somewhere. They're classics now. Me and McGuinness, because we only had 15 minutes, we used to have a bit of fun. And both McGuinness and I were very heavily into satire and ridicule, and we had a lot of fun just doing little satirical takes on various events of that time.
To see,
and then later on Radio Redfern, legendary old Radio Redfern, what a great place.
To see things grow, Gary, I mean, it's obviously essential for us to be in control of our own media, but we're still not utilising it fully and properly. A lot of our mob don't realise the power they have. But what are your thoughts of ownership and control, or blacks in control of their media?
I think it's really important, especially in radio, which is a easily accessible sort of medium. I think it's equally important, you know, for a younger mob to be getting into the internet and all of that. I mean, you know, when I was in my late 40s, and I taught myself how to get onto the really early stages of the internet, you know, where the old dial-up modems and all you had then, there were no websites as such, and I downloaded manuals. I found these bulletin boards where you could download manuals, and I downloaded dozens of manuals on information technology, and the very first computer I got, the first time I looked at it, I said to myself, I want to know how you work. And I took it to pieces and put it back together. And I created the first Aboriginal website in the country, which is that thing you're talking about. Mm. I mean, I need to do a bit of updating on it at the moment, but that's been evolving over, I don't know, 15 years or more now. And it's getting bigger every day, but there's a lot more to go on it. And one of the reasons I created it in the first place, because I got sick of people asking me stupid questions, which is what a lot of students and others sometimes do. And so I found it easy. Look, just go and look at my website. It's on my website. They ask me a silly question. Go and read my website. It's there. And then they go away and wade their way through 3,000 or 4,000 pages trying to find it, but in the process educate themselves.
All right. Some words of advice. We obviously need more people trained up in this technology area, media, along the way. But education, and again, it depends on what sort of education. But identity and culture, Gary, is obviously important, knowing who you are.
Absolutely. Well, that's what you should be deriving strength from, you know, and you should be celebrating the difference. I mean, why would you want to be like them, you know? Why would you want to embrace their values of individualism and materialism, you know? I mean, it's those sort of values that are in the process of destroying the planet, you know? Greed and corruption, you know, that's what comes from individualism and materialism. The blackfellas' way is a better way, you know, seems to me.
No question
and,
about it.
And, you know, I understand that, you know, sometimes young people have difficulty sort of, you know, wrapping their heads around that, but it's not that difficult. But when you consider the highly sophisticated indoctrination systems that we're up against that grab young Koori kids, you know, like religious and educational indoctrination systems, then, you know, it's a tough struggle, but it always was, always will be.
Certainly is. All right, we're getting close to our news time. Thank you very much for your time today. I certainly appreciate that you have the time to give us, and congratulations again on Dr. Foley, the that achievement
is amazing. You
don't have
to call me Doc, cuz.
Right, my brother, it's really good to have you on board and to share.
Yeah.
Share your
thanks
views.
Thanks very much, Tiger. It's always good to talk to you, brother.
Righto, brother. You have a good one and keep up the good work.
Okay, folks.
Talk to you later.
See you later. Bye.
Bye now. Gary Foley. Yes, there certainly isn't another like him around. He certainly got his way with words and things. But he makes some good points, especially those last couple of points. We do not want or need to be like them, and them being the dominant culture, the individualism, the materialism, the greed, the corruption. That is what the dominant culture is about. Look at the Westminster system, the parliamentary structure. Look at it. And we as First Nations people, we do not need to be like that, and we should not want to be like that. Our way is, our values, they are far superior, far superior. And we have to go back in time and value that, recognise that, and try to implement some of that. It's time for me to go. You have a great day. I'm back tomorrow with Let's Talk.